The following podcast is a presentation of the Washington College of Law at American University. Any unauthorized use or distribution is strictly prohibited.
Okay, I think we're ready to get started. Welcome back after lunch to everyone. We're really glad to have you here. My name is David Snyder. I'm a professor of law here and director of the business law program. You know, this time of year is so busy at WCL, and between classes and conferences and events, we have an embarrassment of riches. And this is part of the riches, and it's good to see all of you here taking advantage of this. I want to spend just a moment to mention the business law program to anybody who is not familiar with it, particularly perhaps first years. The business law program does quite a lot, and it has different components. The most important and perhaps most obvious is the academic component. We offer here about 150 courses in business law and business law related topics, which is just extraordinary. I suspect that's more courses than many law schools offer, period. And so you can go to the website and check out this amazing wealth of courses that we have. In addition, we have a number of sessions that we run throughout the year to help you deal with this really immense curriculum, how to choose, things about career choices, how to get a career in business and finance and that sort of thing. We also have social and networking events, and all of that is geared towards students. In addition, we do a fair amount that's more focused on faculty and research. You know, the faculty at a research university spends a lot of its time working on research and publication, and so we have a series that's primarily devoted to faculty work, including guest speakers from the most renowned places and most important offices in the country. And we also do things with alumni, continuing legal education, both here in Washington and elsewhere. And again, lots of opportunities to use the WCL American University network. But the focal point of everything is you, the students. And this terrific program and the fact that we have such a distinguished speaker here today is all thanks to student leaders, the leaders who put the business law brief together, make this symposium happen, make it appear in print, and as you, I'm sure, all know, have transformed it or are transforming it from the business law brief into a business law journal, which is just continuing to raise the profile of the program. But there's nothing we can do that's so good as to bring in just terrific speakers, people who have amazing experience. And today we have the Honorable Bijan Kian here with us. He is a member of the Board of Directors of the Export-Import Bank of the United States. I think his most important accomplishment I don't have in his bio, but something that you have to realize is that he has worked for two presidents, been confirmed by the Senate twice, and has done this all while dealing with both sides of the aisle, Democrat and Republican, and is sitting here smiling. So it can be done, there may not be that many people who can do it, but he has done so. He is a member of the board, as I said, of the Export-Import Bank. That is a position appointed by the president, as well as confirmed by the Senate. He specializes in the Middle East, Central Asia, and the Caucasus, and he particularly emphasizes the services industry in the United States, which, as you know, is such an important part of our economy. He's the former director of the State of California Office of Foreign Investment, where he oversaw the truly staggering $92 billion portfolio of foreign investment in the state of California. That's something that I think could be a great model for the country. In addition, he is quite at home here. He was an adjunct professor of finance in the California State University system. He studied at the University of Sussex. I'm not sure whether he knows this, but we have quite a number of alumni of Sussex here at WCL because of some of our programs with other schools abroad. And he also studied at the Kennedy School, at Harvard, and at Oxford. So it's my pleasure to give you the Honorable Bijan Kian.
Thank you so much, Dr. Schneider, for that very kind introduction. I am here at a university, and whenever I find myself at a university or a classroom, I believe that I'm in a sacred place. I enter with my head lowered in deference to the magnificence of what is most important in our lives and in our future, and that is education. I'm delighted to be here. I want to thank Dean Grossman, Dean of the Washington College of Law at the American University. I want to thank you, sir, for your very kind introduction. I also want to thank a good friend, Yasmin Nakosh, who called me and said, Director Kian, you have to be there. And I said, yes, ma'am, I'll be there, no matter what. She's a delight to know. And I also want to thank Ben Masarsky, who so kindly came and got me at the door and avoided me getting lost, which is not a very difficult thing to do for me. I get lost in buildings often. I want to congratulate the student leadership on business law brief. I picked a copy, and I will definitely go and read it. I tell you why it's such an important thing for me to read that and to be associated with things associated with law, although I'm not an expert in it and certainly claim no authority on it. I have two daughters. My daughter, Christine, is graduating, headed for graduation this May from this great institution, American University. She's a student here, and she's double majoring in international service in something called the Law and Society. So she wants to be a lawyer. And that's my connection to all of you. So with that, I'd like to say a few things. Today, first of all, I just explained to Dr. Schneider that I don't do so well in delivering speeches because thank you for mentioning that I was a humble teacher at one point. But what is more particular about me is that I'm a perpetual student. And because I'm a perpetual student and because I have to continue learning, I cannot stop doing that, I'm going to begin that right now. Before talking to you, I have a few questions for you. You all know that we almost had a catastrophic event of our financial systems collapsing. Started with not exactly the day, but you know we like to pick days and give those days significance, September 15, 2008. How many of you think that the crisis globally and in the United States is over completely? How many of you think the crisis is over? We're done. None? How many of you think that the crisis will be over in the next 6 months? How many of you think the crisis will be over in the next 2 years? I see some hands going up. And how many of you think that we are going to have a double dipper? Okay, so between those who think in the next 2 years there's hope and those who are in the extremes, the silence of we're not over, and then one or two hands on we're going to have another crisis around the corner, I think I've just learned that the extremes are there. There's a cautious expression, and I think I can read that, and I think I'm with you. We keep a cautious eye. We are optimistic because we have to be. We have to be optimistic in order to move forward, but we're cautious because the reality is holding us back. The recovery will be there. It will be slow, and it will be uneven. It will be slow and uneven globally. Some emerging markets are going to see continued growth. Some are going to be slower. It's going to be uneven and slow here in the United States. And although all indicators are that the worst may be over, we cautiously are moving forward and doing everything we can. Certainly the Export-Import Bank of the United States, I was just sharing with Dr. Schneider that we are sometimes the best-kept secret in town. We're a small agency of the United States government. Its job is to provide export credit. When an American producer of goods and services finds it difficult to compete with others, and others bring the German, the French, the Italians, the Korean, the Chinese, the Japanese, and others, bring their products and services to the table with a financing package. Makes it very easy for the buyer to make a decision, but it also makes it very unfair if the American producer is left alone. So that's when we come in. We are a counter-cyclical organization. We sit back when the markets are liquid, when the banks are lending, and when the businesses are happy with getting the kind of financing they need. We go into hyperactive mode when markets slow down. An example of that was last year. Exports were down by about 30%, and our business was up by about 50%. In fact, we had the highest activity of nearly $21 billion in export finance given to American businesses, producers of goods and services last year. It was the highest number in our 75-year history. By law, we are required to put 20 cents of every dollar into that effort. And I'm happy to report to you that $4 billion or so from that total authorizations went to small businesses. So we're fulfilling our mission as we are required, but we are trying to do even more. Because my boss, the President of the United States, in his State of the Union address, and most recently on Thursday, reminded us that his goal is to double our exports in the next 5 years. What does that mean? Doubling exports in the next 5 years means that the companies who export have to double their volume, or perhaps the number of exporting companies have to be doubled. It will be helpful. Or the destinations we export to have to be doubled. It's an interesting tidbit that I share with you that of about 250,000 companies, export-ready companies, they export around the world. Can you guess how many countries they export to? Let's say take the half of that number, 50% of that 250,000 number community export to how many countries? How many of you would say five or more countries? 50% of that number exports to five or more countries. How many of you would say 20 or more countries? A lower number. How many of you would say they just export to one country? Okay, I'm glad I can share something with you that you perhaps didn't have this information. About 50% of the companies export only to one country. That's good news because it means, well, it is not so good news because they're only exporting to one country. It is good news in the way that it is not such an impractical goal to want us to increase and double our exports. All we have to do is to move that up, at least in numbers, not in terms of dollars, because there won't be parity there, to another country. And you guessed it right, that one country is either Mexico or Canada. But there are many places in the world to go. Many places in the world to go. Let me ask you another question. How many of you plan to be engaged in international law? How many of you plan to work in lines of practice that would relate to practice of international law or dealing with transactions that deal with places abroad? Yeah, quite a few. As a non-lawyer, I can only imagine understanding the law in these countries would be very important, don't you think so? Understanding the law would be very important. What other subjects do you think would be extremely important to know when you consider doing business abroad or practicing international law or representing companies abroad or perhaps conflict resolution or anything else? What subjects do you think? I'm trying to get you to talk other than raising your hand. So what countries? What subject is more important, perhaps, in knowing about doing business in other countries? Other than law.
Culture, immigration law.
Did you hear culture? Very important. What else? Culture is important. What else?
Immigration law.
Immigration law is important. Culture is important. Immigration law is important. What else? What else? Okay, two broad subjects I like to suggest are extremely important. These two broad subjects are geography and history. Dr. Schneider, geography and history are not part of the curriculum in law school, are they?
Sure they are.
Of course they are.
Ask me any state capitals.
Yes, of course. Why is geography important in the practice of law? Well, geography is extremely important in the conduct of business. And if the practice of law has anything to do with the conduct of business, then geography, all kinds of geography, political geography, for example, becomes important. Neighboring countries are most likely trade partners. They should be able to do business together. But there are cases where that is not true. Conflicts exist. You want to know about that. You want to know about what makes it possible, and you want to know what makes it difficult in terms of geography to do business. That would be an important issue for you. If I were to give you a tip as to what would differentiate between you and others you compete with in the world out there when it comes to your careers and when it comes to pursuing what makes you successful and reach your goals, I would say learn geography. It's important. I would also say learn history. Now, when I say learn history, the mind wants to go to 400 BC or maybe even earlier. I'm not talking about that kind of history. I'm talking about taking a country and understanding its evolution in the last 100 years, or maybe 50 years, or maybe 5 years. But you really must learn history. It's important. You have to learn what has happened in that market. What makes people do the things they do? What are the norms? What are the changes? I just came back from a tour. I usually, as Professor Schneider kindly mentioned, I work in the Middle East, Central Asia, and the Caucasus. But sometimes my work requires me to be in other countries. I just came back from Russia. I also routinely go to Turkey, a country that is located, again, geography, both in Asia and in Europe. This time I was in Cyprus. And when you look at Cyprus, it has a population of about 800,000 or so. There is an issue in Cyprus. There is a political entity, a country that's only recognized by one country, and it's called the Turkish Republic of Northern Cyprus. The rest of the country is in the south, and there's a lot of activity. You need to know these things if you end up looking at something that deals with each country. Now, I took Cyprus as an example, but big countries, the same way. China. I would say learn the geography of China. Understand what is taking place in China. And and other countries. So these two subjects. What else? What else can I tell you about what would be helpful to you in your search as you move on? I'm talking to students, of course, and I realize that there are distinguished faculty and very experienced individuals who have traveled the world and made things possible, and this information may or may not be particularly useful to them. But I'm talking to students, and I like to stop here for a moment and reflect and ask you again another question. What do you think is the most important thing that I can share with you today? I want to know what's on your mind in the few minutes that we have left before questions and answers. What's the most important thing that you think I can tell you that would be useful to you as you move on? Question. What do you think would be useful to you? Any thoughts, ideas?
How best do we bridge the world between business and law? How best do we, as lawyers, become more like businessmen, or as businessmen, do we become more like lawyers in a way that would be relevant to the world?
Okay, that's a good question. That's a good question. Okay, what else? The bridge between business and law.
From your position at the Export Bank, what do you think are the upcoming trends that we should be aware of as we enter into the field of business law?
Upcoming trends? In business law? Okay. Anything else?
It was mentioned before that you've negotiated successfully both sides of the aisle. I'd be curious how politics has shown its role in directing your policy and how we might be aware of that as we enter into the business world.
In my work. Politics in my work. Very good question. Okay, let me just answer these three as we have our conversation, and then I'm sure we'll have other opportunities. But bridge between business and law is your question. Well, here are my thoughts real quickly. In traditional concepts, the conceptual study of the relationship between law and business, there is a world that is established, there's a world that has a history, there is a world that has precedents. You can look up things that happened in England going back hundreds of years, and there are records of that and so forth. But I would ask you this, how about environments where things are just beginning to shape up? I'll give you a question. Let's say as a lawyer, you get an assignment to help negotiate a lease agreement on a building in Baghdad. The new system. Things are not exactly in place. There's no long history of practice and precedent and decisions that you can refer to. There are nuances, there are difficulties, there's absence of definitive guidelines. There's more questions than there's answers. So how do you even begin to work in such an environment? I say this as a challenge. What does it require? Well, it requires extremely fast learning, a very high appetite for information. Okay, so I don't have clarity on the laws. I have maybe even conflict between practices. What do I have that would help me to work? What are those things? What are some of the institutions that would be useful to me? What are some of the factors that I can use in the absence of what I need to be able to do that? The other thing that's important is in certain countries in the Middle East, you see business rankings, very business friendly. You have to adjust your biases and say, well, you know, people used to think it's not easy to do business in a certain country in the Middle East. If I ask you a question right here, I ask you, sir, the question. What country in the Middle East is on the list of top 15 business-friendliest countries in the world? Can you name a country in the Middle East? Another one? Okay, that's one. Okay, good. More? Business-friendly, Iran?
Certain countries.
Ah, business-friendly. If I were your professor, sir, I'd not give you an A. I can tell you that. But there is a country, and I'll share it with you. Those countries are top rated. They're good answers. The Kingdom of Saudi Arabia, I was told, ranks 13. Business-friendliness. In the world, yes, number 13, yes. Now, I'm told I did not collect those numbers, and certainly I cannot be the source of that information, but I'm told that's the case. However, I'm also told that conflict resolution, dispute resolution, continues to be challenging because often disputes are solved with other norms and other practices, which not the enough time to get into that, but there are some challenges in those areas. They're addressing those. You need to know these things, the bridge between law and business. For safe and sound conduct of business, it is a required component to have good knowledge of the law, compliance with the law. Sometimes business decisions that do not comply with law end up to be bad business decisions because the costs are prohibitive. So it's important to recognize those, and I don't think those are any secrets there. But I hope I've given you some examples about that bridge. And then we talked about upcoming trends in business. Well, I think it's not too difficult for me to tell you that every time we come out of a crisis, our behavior is affected by what we have just experienced. If you go back and study history and look at the year 1907, what was the most significant event that happened in 1907 related to business and crisis? Can you name that incident? Does anyone in the room want to name that incident, 1907? Is this a test? It's a quiz of history? 1907. If I say the initials of the man who was associated in some ways with not the problem, or perhaps both the problem and the solution, depending on whose views you're following, was J.P. Would you know who I'm talking about or the incident?
The financial panic.
I'm sorry, is there a way to get the microphone there? Whose name am I referring to? J.P. who?
Morgan.
J.P. Morgan. And what happened in 1907?
Crash, currency valuation, and stock market.
There's a name I'm looking for. Knickerbocker. Yes, that's the name of the company. So 1907. Every time we come out of a crisis, the crisis affects our behavior. You're looking for trends. The trends are going to be affected in large part by the events that we have seen in the past couple of years. We are going to be cautious. We are going to look around a little bit more when we do things. it is possible that we're going to be less creative. Our creativity in the financial markets, as you all know, became hyperactive. We came up with words that just describe some, you know, inverse convertibles and things like that, and that caused troubles, and something very famous, credit default swaps. How many of you can describe a CDS, a credit default swap? Okay, can you please do it? What's credit default swap? Quickly.
I guess.
Microphone, please.
A credit default swap is an insurance contract on a financial instrument.
Okay. Covers the bet?
Who
covers the bet? Insures? Default? It does something?
Yes, yes.
Why is it called a swap? What is it that's being swapped?
Generally, what's being swapped is you pay against the... It's an insurance contract. We pay a premium.
It is? Oh, you said it's an insurance.
Yes.
Why is it not called an insurance policy and it's called a swap?
Because there's two counterparties in the swap. I think it started as a currency.
If it were to be an insurance policy, then is it not logical to require some sort of measuring the capacity of the insurer?
Yes, and I think it shows that the counterparty risk was not properly evaluated.
My point. So these concepts, although necessary in the operation, they play a role, they have functionality, they have utility, but we're going to be cautious about better defining. We are going to be cautious about better measuring. And what we have to also be careful about is not to overreact. There is a tendency, you asked about business trends, there is a tendency that every time a crisis hits us, we have a tendency to become overreactive. Well, that's not going to be good. Whenever we come out of a crisis like this, banks tend to be shy, as some banks continue to be. But then again, there are instrumentalities, and there are functions within our government, and together with other governments, G20 certainly has taken leadership on this, our country has provided leadership on this, and the agency that I serve certainly plays a small role in providing some of these solutions. Let me give you two examples. Banks are shy in lending, and what we say to them is, go ahead and lend. I'll issue a guarantee to you. You don't have to take the risk. I will take the risk. The United States government, full faith and credit of the United States government behind you, we will take the risk. Go ahead and lend. The banks will come to me and say, yes, but you want me to go and acquire money that's about 5 years or 8 years or 10 years long, and the cost of acquiring that money is high, and you want me to lend at rates that are low. What if the rates go up? I know I have the guarantee on the return of the investment, but how about the return on the investment I make? My rate may end up being very low. You give me a guarantee that guarantees the return of the money, but how about the return on it? May end up being low for 10 years, 12 years. What we say to them is, no problem, go ahead. We guarantee you make the loan, provide the liquidity to the businesses, and what we're going to do is we'll give you what we call a put option in the capital markets. Every time that you feel like, uh-oh, I'm faced with a low-rate asset on my books, bring it back, we'll buy it from you. That way, we make sure that we don't bring the might of full faith and credit of the United States government to the market and stop what banks are doing. We offer this instrument to them to make sure that the markets remain liquid, and we do what we can to encourage them to go ahead and lend. That's one. Another instrument that we bring in, sets a new trend, is we call it the capital markets option. Basically, the reverse of the other one. The banks say, okay, I got that. I got coverage on that. I'll continue to lend. But what if I I do this and it ends up to be very good, and I'm looking at a loan that I've made with a rate that is higher than the one in the market. What if I want to gain back the liquidity, cash that delta, and benefit from that so I look good to my shareholders? Can I do that? And we say yes to them. Yes, you can do that. You can go to capital markets with our guarantee on top of what we provided to you and make it portable and take it to the market. It's easy to go issue a bond with the full faith and credit of the United States government on it, and with our rating, they can cash that. So those are two examples that are coming up. The new trends, I can say just a few more things on that, is that businesses are really coming back to understanding what globalization means. Something happened. We were globalizing. We were doing what it's required to expand to global levels and the interdependencies that exist. And then the crisis brought that. Maybe some sense of protectionism. Although there are no visible signs of that, but I can speak for myself. I was listening to the head of OECD, Angel Guerra, His Excellency Angel Guerra, who was talking about this and giving a report. There is no solid evidence of protectionism, but there may be some desire, some signs. Protectionism is not a good thing. No one wins with protectionism. So these are some of the trends that are coming up. We have to understand the concept of interdependence in economics. We need people to have the ability to buy what we produce, and in order for them to be able to do that, they need to have strong economies. And they need to be able to sell their stuff, their products and services, and in order to buy ours. So we're all interdependent. And personally, this is certainly not the views of the government of the United States, it's my personal view, I'm a believer in the concept of interdependence. I had a talk with a very experienced man in the energy field. He headed up one of the world's largest energy companies. And I said to him, frankly, I said, so what do you think about this idea that we are, kind of dependent on your energy, your oil and these prices? I mean, what do you say? Makes it very difficult. I mean, I paid almost $4 a gallon for gas. It's for a government worker, I can feel it. And he said, look, let me speak openly and frankly with you. There is such a thing called equilibrium. You believe in it? I said, yes, of course. He said, there's such a thing as about producer responsibility and consumer responsibility. And if I produce responsibly, and if you consume responsibly, then maybe we will have a responsible price as a result of that. I really couldn't argue with him on that point. I found myself in a position of saying, you're right. In order for me to reduce my dependence and balance the interdependence, I'll have to be concerned about my own consumption. I expect you to produce responsibly, but I expect myself to be able to consume responsibly. I travel all over the world, and in some countries, it amazes me that people leave their air conditioners on when they go on vacation. That does happen. That does happen. I'm not making that up. There's so much we can conserve. There's so much we can actually relate to cost reductions, to be understanding of these aren't political concepts. So, we have to get used to conserving energy. We have to get used to consuming less. So I see these trends coming up, and I have given you some examples. The other question that came up was about politics. You asked, Ben asked the politics question. Professor Schneider kindly mention that I carry this great humbling honor that I have served two presidents of the United States from two different parties, and I have gone through two Senate confirmations with two different majorities being in place, and I'm humbled that I received a passing grade in the form of a unanimous vote of confirmation. I'm humbled by it. The weight of the responsibility is on my shoulders, and therefore it makes me lower my head and be humble about it, physically. I mean, when the load is on my shoulders, it makes my head go down, and that's a good place for it to be. But to answer your question, the Export-Import Bank of the United States operates. You asked this question within the context of my work, and I'd like to give you an answer. When we go to work every day, there's seven members of the board. Two of them are cabinet members. Ambassador Kirk is the United States Trade Representative, and the Honorable Gary Locke is the Secretary of Commerce. Then there's five of us. There are ex officios. We vote on transactions. If any of you are present at our board meetings and you do not have the information of who's a Republican and who's a Democrat, it is extremely difficult for anyone to be able to detect the colors. You will not be able to see it. It just does not exist. It is the nature of our work. Maybe I'm lucky. Maybe I can just write this off to a great thing that has happened. I work at an institution where partisanship has no role. I won't even say very little role. There's no role. We work for exporters. We are a small agency, less than 400 people. We did $21 billion of business last year. We really don't have time to think about anything other than how fast we can run, how hard we can work, so that no American exporter is left out from a competition. I'm not saying something politically appealing. I'm just telling you as I see it. This is our work. This is how we do it. We have the administration changed. New team came on. And if anything, more excitement and more energy into the building behind our mission. And we're looking at identifying priority markets. We're looking at streamlining our process. We have a strategic initiative going on. I think I like to say we are a model agency in working together to making things happen. And with that, I think I'm just very lucky to have had the opportunity to be here with you, to talk to you, to have this conversation. Time is never enough. I always leave these opportunities with 1,000 questions in my head. Never happy and satisfied. I hope I get a chance to come back. I hope I get a chance to visit with all of you so we could have better, longer conversations. And I'm going to stop here and see if I can answer any questions for you. I hope this has been a useful exchange for you, as it has been for me. And thank you very much, Dr. Schneider.
So I think we have time for just a few questions. Any questions?
Yes. Mic over.
Thank you. I was wondering, from your position, we hear a lot about the twin deficits problem and sort of lack of exports, and as you noted, Obama has this goal of increasing exports, doubling exports in the next 5 years. Do you see, whether it's a quantitative in terms of number of countries or in terms of volume of exports increasing, do you see a realistic prospect of that narrowing the twin deficits problem that we face? And do you think that problem is as real and as dire as it's made out to be?
Let me see if I can understand the question. You are referring to my boss, the President of the United States, direction of doubling exports in 5 years.
And
you're saying whether that means it means we're doubling exports to more countries by more companies, or is it in numbers or is it in dollars? You're trying to put a tighter frame on that.
Well, I think it's more about the nature of the problem of the twin deficits that we face in terms of current accounts and capital accounts and our foreign trade, and whether you realistically see that narrowing in the near future?
That's a very good question. You're referring to the current account and the capital account. You're referring to the ability to attract foreign investment, and you're referring to the ability to reduce trade deficit in the current account. Is it a realistic goal? For the reasons I shared with you, look, if you ask me, well, you know, you want to double the exports. Everybody wants to double the exports, right? Okay, yeah, yes. But who's going to have the greatest ability in this competitive environment to capture the opportunity and do it? We are the United States of America. We have the means. We have a chain of support behind our companies that could be activated from Department of Commerce, from Trade Development Agency, from overseas private investment corporations, from Exim Bank. Take a look at us. Our preparation, yes. Is the battle real? Absolutely. Are we taking it as if it's an easy thing to do? Absolutely not. Is it difficult? Yes, it is difficult. Is it reasonable to have that goal? Absolutely. I take this, again, as my personal opinion. The fact that the President of the United States is setting a vision, a goal, and saying, this is what I want you to do. You earn a living, Bijan Kian, by going to work every day and taking steps to double the exports in the next 5 years, and you're not alone. You're not alone. I'm not just asking you to do this. There's a whole chain of support, and you play your small part in it, and you make sure that you do that. What it means is that I have to work harder, of course. Our companies have to work harder. We have to make it possible for them. I have to be more aggressive in the support that I provide for the companies. But as far as preparation goes, again, reasonably said, we have what we need. It is possible. We can do that. Look, I just gave you statistics. Half of the companies that export only export to one country. And you know why? Because the small companies are sitting back and saying, I'm a small company. One, I cannot leave my office. If I'm not there for 2 or 3 days, who's gonna watch the store? Then, you know, it's expensive to travel, half a world over to go negotiate a contract. I need lawyers, marketing experts, and other consultants. Big companies can do that. Smaller companies have a hard time. This chain of support is right behind them to make that possible. Do I sound optimistic? Absolutely. But I have to be. How can I start my work in a day and saying I can't do it? I cannot do that. I have to say I'm going to go to work today and I'm going to make that happen. And, you know, we often undercalculate our own abilities. We have more capacity than we know as individuals. And I can talk about myself. I often say, oh, my goodness, how am I going to get through this day? How am I going to do this today? Is it reasonable? Is it a reasonable goal that I have 17 meetings today? Is it a reasonable goal that I have to brief 7 members of the United States Congress? And is it reasonable that I have to give a talk quickly with great honor at the American University? These are all real numbers. That's what I have to do, and I will do it. I will do it. So I hope I've answered your question.
Well, thank you very much. I know there are lots more questions, but I know the organizers are keeping things running on time, which is admirable, and I think I have to say thank you and present you on behalf of the Business Law Brief and American University this token of our appreciation.
Thank you, Dr. Schneider. It's been a pleasure.